This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. The two-year-long special counsel investigation into possible connections between the Donald Trump presidential campaign and Russia is over. And so begins the battle over making it public. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has a report.
With news that Attorney General William Barr has received special counsel Robert Mueller's report, there are renewed calls to
make that report public.
Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Congressman Ted Lieu, a Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, says they're still investigating alleged wrongdoing by the Trump campaign and the president himself.
Potential crimes, including obstruction of justice, witness tampering, abuse of power.
Political analyst Dr. Larry Sabato says he believes the attorney general will release what should be made public. And if something is withheld,
there can always be someone who leaks. There can always be a whistleblower.
President Trump continues to call the investigation a witch hunt. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
There are indications the Justice Department may release the Mueller report's main findings sometime this weekend. More on that from AP's Eric Tucker.
The Attorney General indicated that he would consult with both the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and Special Counsel Mueller about subsequent and future releases and what information from the original report can be made public going forward. All that Congress has received as we speak right now is the letter from the Attorney General indicating that he's received the report and then he'll be back in touch.
In Somalia, al-Shabaab terrorists set off two car bombs in Mogadishu. One of the targets was a building that housed a pair of government ministries. Among the five killed, the country's deputy labor minister. Officials in southern Afghanistan say at least four people were killed and 30 or more wounded in a pair of explosions at an agricultural show in Helmand province. Witnesses said a small explosion inside a stadium tent was followed by another, apparently targeting people who were trying to escape. This is VOA News. U.S.-backed forces say they've liberated the final bit of Islamic State territory in Syria. The last ground under the group's control, the town of Baghouz, slipped away over the past few days. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden spoke about the fall of Baghouz.
And coalition officials said that the ISIS fighters were resorting to what they described as gruesome tactics and using even children as human shields as they defended their last bits of territory. And so there was concern that in addition to the fighters, there may have been some civilians, women and children, ISIS families, but non-combatants who were sticking with the fighters until the very bitter end.
The State Department official who oversees Syrian affairs is William Roebuck.
While we have completed the territorial defeat of ISIS in Syria and Iraq, we still have much work to do to achieve an enduring defeat of ISIS. We've been clear that the campaign is not over.
Syrian Democratic Forces commander Maslam Abdi, through a translator, left little room for doubt in his victory announcement.
We announce today the destruction of the so-called Islamic State organization and the end of its ground control in its last pocket in Baghouz region.
Aid agencies are working to deliver help to hundreds of thousands of African survivors of Cyclone Idai. The World Health Organization is voicing alarm over temporary housing conditions. Here is Lisa Schlein for VOA from Geneva.
WHO spokesman Christian Lindmeier says conditions in the temporary camps sheltering the displaced are squalid and ripe for disease outbreaks.
In terms of cholera, in the past 6 years, there has been a cholera outbreak every year in Mozambique. So most recent one ended only in February 2018 with close to 2,000 cases.
The WHO has sent a team of experts to oversee the operation in Mozambique. It also has sent emergency medical supplies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands of people gathered Friday for a mass funeral in a cemetery in Christchurch, New Zealand, where 26 of the 50 victims of a mass shooting at two mosques last week were buried. The youngest victim was 3 years old. Earlier, in a park across from the Al Noor Mosque, where the worst of the attacks took place, there was a Muslim call to prayer. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern attended. The event was broadcast live on radio and TV. Today in Christchurch, there was a march for love. Australia is being hit by two powerful Category 4 cyclones. Cyclone Trevor, with winds of 250 kilometers an hour, made landfall on the country's remote northern coast. Cyclone Veronica was headed for Australia's western coast. Gene Randall, VOA News.
welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington.
Are encouraged to participate and participate peacefully and participate in a way and manner that the process will be credible, the process will be fair, the process will be acceptable to all stakeholders in the process.
The Nigerian Independent National Electoral Commission organizes supplementary elections Saturday.
Elections are just for a while, but we are Malawians and we will remain Malawians. And it is our interest, one, to have right leaders that will forge the country ahead.
The chairperson of the Malawian Electoral Commission wants to ensure a successful May 21 general election.
There are two persons that could be competing with President Azali. There is Ahmad Mahmoudou from the party Jua of former President Sambi. And there is Colonel Salih Mohamed Kampanya.
And Comorians go to the polls to choose a new president and regional representatives Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, organized supplementary elections in some states in accordance with the electoral law Saturday. The elections were organized in some parts of the country due to voter irregularities, among others. This after opposition groups accused the government of what they described as the over-militarization of the polls. They also expressed concern that the electoral body is biased in favor of the ruling party. For reaction regarding Saturday's supplementary elections, I reach Aliyu Bello, spokesperson for INEC.
Supplementary elections is not across the whole country. It's across 18 states of the federation. Those 18 states are actually affected by this procedure. And it is essentially for the state houses of assembly elections and a few for the governorship elections. In respect of governorship election, we are conducting in 4 states instead of 6. When in fact, the remaining 2 that are not part of are affected by a legal proceeding. There is a court verdict that restrains the commission from going ahead with the conduct of elections in Adamawa and in respect of Bauchi State, where we are supposed to have the supplementary elections. We could not proceed because one of the local governments where the commission intends to go and collect the results, the courts now restrain the commission from proceeding with the procedure until after the determination of a suit before a federal and a state high court in respect of Bauchi and Adamawa State, respectively. However, we are proceeding with the state houses of assembly elections in those states.
What is INEC doing in order to prevent the occurrences which forced the Electoral Commission basically to have this supplementary election in terms of violence, voter irregularities, in terms of really intimidating and harassing voters who will be casting their ballot?
Well, actually, the circumstances upon which the supplementary election arise were on account of unforeseen situations where we had challenges of concluding the polls in those locations. But we do hope during this Saturday election, the polls will be conducted freely, fairly, and successfully. Intimidation and apathy shouldn't have come because already the commission has put in place enough measures to ensure safety and security of all participants and all stakeholders in the process. And the apathy shouldn't have even come because these are almost, I can say, the deciding votes in both states where governorship elections are involved.
What is INEC doing special regarding the supplementary elections? What is different?
Essentially, it's about effective deployment of staff and material to those locations and also ensuring that voters are encouraged to participate and participate peacefully and participate in a way and manner that the process will be credible, the process will be fair, the process will be acceptable to all stakeholders in the process.
Aliyu, some people have expressed concern about what they described as the over-militarization of the elections this year organized by INEC. How do you respond to such criticisms?
Securing the electoral process is a collective responsibility of both the commission and law enforcement agents as well, as you know. And police are actually the lead agency in terms of provision of security of persons and materials in the polls. However, where military personnel are deployed in some quarters are actually there maintaining the necessary bit they normally keep. So we don't employ and we don't engage the services of military people across the polling unit. And actually the voting and all everything about the election process, about the elections, happen at polling unit levels. That is where the voters and the commission come in together. So there is no deployment of military personnel at polling unit levels. But if you find them doing some legitimate assignments in some locations, provide security, looking at the situation of security in Nigeria, one would have nothing to say or to add or subtract other than to recognize the fact that the law enforcement agents are doing their legitimate duties. However, if on account of doing their own legitimate duties, they end up intimidating voters, that is not a welcome development, and we do not hear reports of such intimidations.
Now, the PDP, the main opposition party, accused INEC of holding emergency meeting recently with the ruling party, and that it is meant to scuttle the special elections as well, undermine its integrity to favor the ruling party, the APC. How do you respond to such accusations?
I'm actually not in the picture. I'm hearing it for the first time from you, sir.
Aliyu Bello is the spokesperson for the Nigerian Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The Malawian Electoral Commission says officials are working to ensure a successful May 21 general election. This after the electoral body announced this week that political parties can now campaign in the run-up to the presidential, legislative and local representative elections. The commission warned that it will monitor the campaigns to prevent harassment and intimidation of opponents before the elections. For more on the preparation for the upcoming polls, I reach Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, chairperson for the Malawian Electoral Commission.
The Malawian Electoral Commission, so far, is on the right course. We have gone through most of the processes without any hitches. They've been successful from registration that started in June last year. After registration, we had the verification. After verification of registration, we had nomination. After nomination, we have had the vetting of ballot paper templates, which has all these processes have been a success and on time. Now we have launched the campaign period according to law. It has to be 60 days. So the 60 days started on Tuesday, 19th March. It will go up to 19th May.
Well, so Dr. Ansah, what's next after campaign begins for these political parties before the elections?
Yeah, what's next is that the official campaign period is open. So all political parties, all candidates, they are free to go and begin to campaign. But there are, you know, guidelines to avoid clashing and so forth and so on. It has to be all orderly. So we've got the guidelines that first come, first serve when they want to use the particular venue. They have to register, you know, just to show that on such a day, they will be at such a place to do a campaign. At the same time, this campaign is closely monitored by the Malawi Electoral Commission to ensure that there is no violence and that the campaign is issue-based and not howling insults on each other.
So are there any punitive actions that the Malawi Electoral Commission could take, or perhaps in conjunction with security agencies like the police, if indeed a political party and their supporters perhaps try to violate some of these conditions that they're supposed to abide by in the electoral process?
Well, violence, intimidation, insults, they are all proscribed. You know, some of these issues, they are criminal in nature. So our criminal system will take care of them. The police are aware, and I'm sure they are on their toes to ensure that everything goes peacefully without any disruption of mostly to violence. Both the general violence and the violence against women. All violence, it will be caught up by the law itself.
We understand that former President Joyce Banda pulled out of the election, endorsing one particular candidate before the election. Do you anticipate any other alliance, and will the law allow such people who withdraw from the ballot papers to be used for the elections?
Well, concerning alliances at this point in time, it is just agreement between political parties or individuals. We do not regulate that. It's up to them. They can go into alliances. But when at this time, if any candidate wants to withdraw, it is in a good time, because I believe after next week, it will be difficult. They can still withdraw, but after next week, if they withdraw, their particulars will still be on the ballot paper. So the best time for them is to withdraw before the printing of the ballot.
What is the Malawi Electoral Commission's message to the people of Malawi ahead of the May 21 general election?
Yes, the message to Malawians is that for them, it is their right to choose their own representative, and for them to make informed choice, they should be patronizing the campaign rally so that they can know the issues and then come up with a decision as to who they think will best represent them. And also that party followers should also ensure that they do not engage in violence. But that all parties and the candidates, they must exercise tolerance, and they must understand that they should be able to live side by side, because elections are just for a while. But we are Malawians and will remain Malawians. And our interest is one, to have right leaders that will forge the country ahead.
Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, the chairperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission. She spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Comorians go to the polls to choose a new president and regional representative Sunday. But some opposition candidates are expressing concerns the presidential election could be compromised in favor of incumbent President Azali Assoumani. The opposition candidates say their representatives are being prevented from monitoring the polling stations and hence the elections, a move they say is designed to rig the elections. But supporters of the president deny the accusation, saying there are indications that the opposition will lose the vote. For the latest update, I read Mohamed Mshangama, a political analyst in the capital, Maroni.
It's rather peaceful, but I'm beginning to be very much worried, because right now the 12 candidates opposing the actual, you know, incumbent president have been to the Independent Electoral Commission complaining that their representatives in the poll stations, for many of them, they have been not been accepted as such, what should have been done by the law. At the same time, also, civil society, like in 2016, they had to pair themselves with some funds from the European Union to put observers in all poll stations with smartphones to make pictures of the results and so on, so as to guarantee, you know, a transparent election. And that has not been accepted.
Does that mean the concerns being expressed by these civil society groups as well as opposition candidates, if not resolved,
the integrity or the transparency of the election could be tainted?
Yes. I mean, at least the candidates say clearly that they will not accept the results. The Minister of Interior was, I don't know whether he was awkward, but he said publicly last week that President Azali would win in the first round, if only because he, as Interior Minister, would be the one reading the results. You can take it as you want, you know, but we are hoping that we'll have peaceful elections. I know that also the journalists, until now, in all former elections, they could go wherever they wanted on the island. Now, the Minister of Interior said that journalists, they have to be restrained to special zones.
How are Comorians reacting to such measures being implemented that opposition groups are condemning?
All the candidates, they have been touring the islands. It's only yesterday and that some of them are back to Grand Comore, you know, the capital, you know. So it's as if they are very surprised because they were not prepared to this.
Do you anticipate a runoff? And who, by your estimation, stands a better chance of giving the incumbent president a run for his money?
Looking at the candidates, it is very difficult, you know, to think that it would just go on the first round just like that, you know, because some of them, there are at least three or four of them who have a proven record, you know, as with good, you know, electorate. I remember President Azali in 2016, he was third with 14%. There is really nothing at this moment that can show that he could double the vote. I think President Azali may be, you know, I think he will be one of the contenders on the second round. There are two persons that could be competing with President Azali. There is Ahmad Mahmoudou from the party Jua of former President Sambi. And there is Colonel Solihi Mohamed Campagnard. And a third could be former Governor Mwinyi Baraka.
Mohamed Mshangama is a political analyst in the Comoro Island. He spoke with me from Moroni. The standoff between Rwanda and Uganda continues, with Rwanda accusing Uganda of hosting or supporting individuals hostile to the country, a claim Kampala denies. The rift came to a climax recently when Rwanda partially closed its border with Uganda and issued a travel advisory to its citizens against traveling to Uganda. Rwanda also issued a travel advisory to its citizens against traveling to Burundi. Charles Mwanguya Mpaji is the bureau chief of the East African, a major regional newspaper in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. My colleague Douglas Impuga asked him about the current situation.
There hasn't been much of developments, both at the diplomatic front and at the border itself. Only that the population seems to be moving on, especially the Ugandan population, and the story is beginning to recede to the inner pages of newspapers. No movement of commercial traffic from Uganda to Rwanda is still being allowed, and we understand that Rwandans are still being prevented from crossing the border into Uganda. What we have seen also is maybe at a higher level, Kampala has had a visit from the Congolese president. You know, both Rwanda and Uganda share a common border with Congo, and their clashes started in that country in 1999 with the Kisangani clashes. So a new Congolese president, Felix Tshisekedi, was in Kampala last night, and President Paul Kagame traveled to Angola and had meetings there. The import of those meetings so far is still scanty.
You refer to those meetings, and there seems to have been a lot of diplomatic legwork in the region. Kenya's President Kenyatta was in both countries. Now you say Tshisekedi was in Kampala and Kagame was in Angola. Do you think this dispute could be resolved diplomatically?
I wouldn't give that a lot of currency. At the East African, we ran a story in our issue last week that when Uhuru Kenyatta came to Kampala, he walked back empty-handed. And there is still debate over what President Kagame's journey to Angola would achieve in terms of influencing Kampala's position, which has chosen to remain largely silent, except for that letter that was revealed in the media. President Museveni wrote to his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, sometime back. Yes, the region is concerned. The issue must be resolved. But whether the two principals are keen at this stage to engage in any kind of discussion remains still in doubt.
We heard yesterday that Rwanda also prevented its citizens from traveling to Burundi. Can Rwanda sustain this standoff given that it's a landlocked, tiny country?
That's the interesting bit that everybody has been asking. The situation with Burundi has been running for much longer than the media has reported or has been discussed publicly, because Rwanda and Burundi have had issues for a much, much longer period of time. The question that you raise is critical. Rwanda is a small economy, a small country that is completely landlocked. The one it's now clashing with, Uganda, is much bigger, both in terms of population, economic size, and the size of the economy, than Rwanda, but also landlocked on all sides. Burundi is also another landlocked country. So if these countries decide to lock themselves in, you wonder who would stand to benefit. Though any analyst would tell you that a country like Uganda would be in a better position because you have options. You have borders open with Kenya, that's a large border. You have another large border open with South Sudan. You have another large border open with the Democratic Republic of Congo. And therefore, you're able to move freely and your economy can substitute what you lose in terms of exports to Rwanda by exporting to these other markets. The question is, if Rwanda locks herself in, who does it trade with and how will it be able to move, especially its imports and exports, through the main seaport that these countries use, which is the Mombasa seaport? We know that the meeting that President Kagame made, the visit he made to Dar es Salaam a day after closing the border, was partly meant to try and open the route, the sea route through Tanzania, and we have heard that there is consideration of avoiding coming through Kampala, through Uganda for Rwanda's imports and exports, through a route from Mombasa down to Mwanza and end up in Kigali. Whether that can be achieved in the short run or in the long run is a question whose answer we'll see.
Charles Mwanguhia Mpaji is the bureau chief of the East African, a major regional newspaper. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. Second round of UN-mediated talks aimed at finding a solution to the Western Sahara conflict has ended with no concrete resolution, but with an agreement by the Moroccan and the Polisario Front delegations to meet again. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Getting parties in a dispute that has lasted 43 years to agree to keep talking is in and of itself an achievement, albeit a small one. UN mediator, former German president Horst Köhler, says finding a solution to the Western Sahara conflict will not be easy. He says there still is a lot of work ahead.
Nobody should expect a quick outcome because many positions are still fundamentally diverging. At the same time, being able to listen to each other, even when things get controversial, is an important step to build trust.
Morocco annexed the mineral-rich Western Sahara in 1975. A 16-year war between the kingdom and the indigenous Sahrawi people, led by the Polisario Front, ended in 1991 with a UN-brokered truce. But the parties remain deeply divided. The Polisario Front is steadfast in its demand that Western Sahara become an independent state. The delegation says its aim in the UN-mediated talks is to achieve its people's inalienable right to self-determination and independence. Morocco rejects independence for Western Sahara, but says it is willing to grant wide-ranging autonomy to the region. Köhler says many people whose lives are directly affected by the conflict are placing their hope in the peace process. He says it will take genuine effort by the parties to build the trust necessary to make progress.
The costs of this conflict, in terms of human suffering, lack of prospects for the youth, and security risks are far too high to be accepted. Therefore, we must not relent in our search for a compromise.
Kurla says the opposing delegations agree the whole Maghreb region would greatly benefit from a solution to the question of Western Sahara. He says they have agreed to meet again at a time still to be determined. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Benin, talks between parliamentarians from the ruling party and the opposition to resolve political tensions appear to have reached a stalemate with no solution in sight. This despite efforts by the Speaker of Parliament to resolve the stalemate. Meanwhile, local media reports say regional leaders from the Economic Community of West African State, or ECOWAS, as well as the United Nations, seek to send representatives to help resolve the sharp disagreement between the two groups. For analysis, VOA French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondin reached attorney Sadiku Alao in the Beninois capital, Cotonou.
Benin is no more a peaceful democracy since about 2 years because a businessman has taken control of everything, not respecting the constitution, creating new laws. Only his parties have been authorized and has been recognized as the only valid political parties. All the opposition parties, those who have been existing since more than 20 years, cannot be accepted to participate in the election.
Well, officially, opposition parties cannot participate because they failed to submit a certificate of conformity. Can you explain why?
The government realized that his own parties cannot fulfill the conditions at the date that has been fixed in the law. Then, the president of the Constitutional Court, personal lawyer of the head of state who has been appointed, creates a new condition to be accepted to participate in the election is to have a certificate delivered by the Minister of Interior. So he creates a new legislation, a new article of law, where he has not been habilitated to do so. And all the existing political parties cannot obtain this certificate. Only the political parties created by the head of state have obtained this certificate.
The certificate of conformity seems to not be the only issue right here. Opposition had requested before to review the law, especially the Article 80, to basically go to the election with the previous laws. What happened since?
Instead of doing that, the head of parliament just proposed to amend the new laws, but by amending them, he needs time to implement the new condition. Instead of having the mandate being finishing in May, they will extend it by 1.5 months. And he said, and the government said with him, that they will extend the power or the existence of the present parliament. But unfortunately, most of the constitutional people said that there is no need to extend the power of this parliament. Their term is finished, they should go. And this is the problem of Article 80, as which you are referring to.
As we're speaking, there is still ongoing negotiation. Does it mean that the government really wants to find solution to this crisis?
Now they are all thinking of what can they do since the ECOWAS people, since the United Nations are sending observers to tell them that this is unfair to exclude all the opposition parties from the election. They are now in a big mess and they don't know themselves what to do. The head of state is telling that he will make all is possible so that everyone will participate in the election. In the other hand, the two political parties which depends on him are saying something else. They want the power of parliament to be extended, but in reality, let me tell you, all this confusion is created because the head of state party and himself know that they are so unpopular that they cannot be re-elected.
Sadiku Alao is an attorney in Benin. He spoke with VOA French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondin from Cotonou. High-ranking Refugees International advocate with a special representative to the Secretary General for the Central African Republic says the United Nations mission there needs significant support with its mission. Alexandra Lamarche, who was recently in the Central African Republic, witnessed the challenges to the UN mission known as MINUSCA faces. This following the recent signing of a peace accord between the government and armed groups to end the conflict. For more about the latest development, I reach Alexandra Lamarche.
The needs in the Central African Republic are enormous. In a country of 4.6 million, which is not that big, 2.9 million are in need of humanitarian aid. Those numbers are pretty staggering. Over a million have been forced out of their homes, either displaced internally or forced into neighboring countries. There's a pretty significant population in Chad, in the DRC, and in Cameroon. Obviously, this has been ongoing since the 2013-2014 war. There are some improvements. I worked there in 2017, and having gone back in 2018, you get to see sort of how things have evolved, both for the good and the bad. Areas have stabilized, and certain populations have been able to return to their homes, which is great. And it's a great victory for these people to be able to sort of regain their normal lives. But on the other hand, other areas that were stable, even at the height of the civil war, have since spiraled into violence. So there's some worrying trends and some opportunities for hope at the same time.
Would you say the peace accord is currently holding?
I would say it is and it isn't at the same time. I think that it does signal a shift and it offers opportunities for improved, you know, stability and hopes for peace in the long term. However, I think that a lot of the terms of the agreement were quite ambitious. And if they're not implemented properly, people will lose sort of interest in it or faith in it. And we're already seeing that with armed groups having either violated the terms of the agreement or having completely withdrawn from the agreement. The government is making, you know, small efforts to have a more inclusive government. But what that actually means for sustainable change is still to be seen. And we have to be honest, the Central African government lacks a lot of the capabilities to implement a lot of these things. So, you know, it's a good step. But there's a lot of work to be done, and we have to see if the government and international supporters have the elbow grease to make it happen.
So tell me, what are some of the challenges the United Nations Multidimensional Integration Stabilization Mission in the CAR, or MINUSCA as they call them, face in the country?
I mean, MINUSCA does great work, but we have to be honest about the fact that, I mean, it's underfunded and understaffed. It's up, around 11,000 troops in a country of 4.6 million, and it has the mandate to protect them all. That's, 4.6 million people to protect in an area that, is pretty wildly unstable. And certain areas have been able to be stabilized with the thanks of MINUSCA, but there are some significant concerns about how those areas or the approaches that were used in those areas can be used elsewhere. I mean, we saw it in the city of Paua, where MINUSCA was able to stabilize an area of 50 kilometers around the city of Paua. However, groups in that area tend to be less sophisticated as they are elsewhere. There's the added bonus of the MINUSCA troops stationed there being from Cameroon, and this city is very close to the Cameroonian border, so they have more of a vested interest. So it's just sort of the perfect, situation to stabilize that area, whereas a lot of the areas such as Bria and Bambahi and areas that we're seeing now that used to be stable, such as Bangassou and Obo and Zemio, now spiraling into violence with, a different level of sophistication of the armed groups. So how well MINUSCA does in those areas doesn't quite compare to where they are successful in the West.
So, Alexandra, what are some of the recommendations would you suggest that could help both MINUSCA as well as the government?
I mean, MINUSCA does a lot of great work, but I think we need to be funding them better. We need to provide them with the money to do what we've mandated them to do. I think that the mandate that was agreed on in December is great, and there was a lot of political support for certain aspects of it, but no financial backing. And unless donors are going to pony up what needs to be given, the MINUSCA forces can't be expected to do the job that we're asking them to do. We've asked them to work on upcoming elections, so there's an election later budget for 2020-2021, but we've offered no funding for them to do that. So, you know, we're putting them between a rock and a hard place. We're setting expectations that are unrealistic. So my biggest thing would be to ask for, obviously, increased funding, you know, more attention on the Central African conflict in general, and some more nitty-gritty solutions could be things like troop rotation. In certain areas, we're seeing the troops are rotating in for a mere 3 months, and other areas, they're there for up to a year. So this is a weird dynamic where some people are not staying long enough to get a sense of the conflict and to be very, very effective, whereas others are staying far too long and becoming fatigued and less responsive to the conflict.
Alexandra Lamarche is the Refugees International Advocate to the Special Representative to the Secretary General for the Central African Republic. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You are hearing Aslay with Nyanga Anyanga. He will be followed with Vinka with Nkubika, and then Loco featuring Mr. Liu comes with Supporter, and then Mao Sama featuring Hanstone comes your way with Iokote, and then Davido with Aye, and then we top it off with Sanapei Tande with Ankulahu.
Sasambua, kimaliza kupika kazi yangu kupakua Kimaliza kufua kazi yangu kukamua Ukitaka mua na umenya na kugea unakula Uchungu wangu unaujua wewe Uchungu wako na ujua gamimi mwenye Pirika pirika za kukuna mwewe Tuinjo inato alazi situsumbu Wanapata kabu, wanajona Chukua Umeniweza nyanga nyanga Ayu Nyanga 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 Baby yo Sijateleza nyanga nyanga
system in that Ugandan system. Lord, it's true. Sin. And a bit songs of it. We didn't have to write them. It is a sun, you name bam. Then no gaze and no bam. Hey, bomu, yo, bulam. Please, boy, me begging you, please. Imu, jimu, physically fit. Your body, me only medicine. And to me, at kukwa, sister, please. I only baba when you tell me baba. I go low when you tell me go low. I lay low when you tell me lay low. I go down for you, I kill one for you. Kubika and Kubikura. Then Kubika and Kubikura. I love you, we need a reply. Then Kubika and Kubikura. Kubika and Kubikura. Then Kubika and Kubikura. I love you.
kuliko uzio ula baby tsumuluzo edita nizelele tiligwa titia kuwagida mbuja kasepichiko baby will you get along for me will you spend it all on me baby will you get along for me will you spend it all on me I am the baba when you tell me babo I go low when you tell me go low I lay low when you tell me lay low I go down for you I kill one for you Kiss me, boy, you consume me. Kubika nen kubikula, zen kubika nen kubikula. I love you, me need a reply. Zen kubika nen kubikula, kubika nen kubikula. Zen kubika nen kubikula. I love you, me need a reply. Zen kubika nen kubikula.
Kill the dance floor. Yes, the Omar.
Celestial do the beats again. Mr. Leo in the flow.
Now, cow. Y'est mort.
Je t'aimerai de toutes mes forces, baby, même dans la vie d'après. Jusqu'à la mort, I will never love you any less. Y'aura des hauts et des bas qui vont nous secouer. Mais lorsqu'on dit qu'on s'aime, on n'a qu'à supporter. Je ne suis pas parfait, mais tu me connais.
She like it. baddest. No need know you the baddest. Oh yeah, shake your assets. Make him man no go forget. Emergency.
Ankula, who we earned the music segment. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, the ever-friendly John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the hunter's name is always connected to the meat of the elephant. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.